Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Also on WLOBradio.com and then also on TideSmartRadio.com. You could find today's show as well as all of our past shows. We have a busy couple of hours here this morning, so we'll run through a couple of on this day notes. Today, February 22nd, is a birthday shared by George Washington and Ted Kennedy. Also, what happened on this day in 1980, this was when the U.S. Olympic hockey team, as people remember, Do You Believe in Miracles, they won when they defeated the Soviets. So that was kind of a big deal. Also, Shani, your favorite group, Milli Vanilli, won a Best New Artist Grammy, right? And then it was, they were found out to be big fakers, right? This is, I don't know why we're celebrating Milli Vanilli. Shani, was this your favorite group or something growing up?
I did like them. I used to dance around to them, yeah.
Yeah, so that was on this day. But we have enough of that, the Milli Vanilli stuff. Let's get to our first interview. This person had come in yesterday, and we spent an hour talking, and it was really one of the most fascinating discussions I've had here on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. We had Colleen Hilton. She is the mayor of Westbrook, and she is also the CEO for V&A Home Health Hospice. They do primarily home care. So we'll get right to that interview. And then in the second hour, just after 12 noon at about 12:06, we'll be replaying an interview I did with Nancy Smith from Grow Smart Maine, another fascinating interview with somebody who's really making an impact in the state of Maine. So thank you for being with us. And now let's go into our first interview with Colleen Hilton. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. And it is Saturday, February 22nd. It is a hazy shade of winter. But we're going to brighten things up here with our first guest. Please join me in welcoming Colleen Hilton, Mayor Colleen Hilton from Westbrook, also CEO of V&A Home Health Hospice. Thank you so much for being here today, Colleen.
Thanks for having me.
We have so much to talk. Just before we went on the air, you asked me about the focus areas, and I am fascinated and impressed with your career trajectory. So there's not one area that I'd like to cover today. There's about 42. But between your experience in municipal government, healthcare, leading one of the largest healthcare organizations in the state, and also your time involved with education, which I think you continually get involved with, but you're also on the school committee. So I want to talk about all that. But before we do, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your background. In my notes, I show that you grew up in Westbrook.
Right.
But so you're one of the few original Mainers then, right?
Well, actually, I wasn't born in Maine, so
okay.
I don't know if I can call myself original.
But you grew up in Westbrook.
I grew up in Westbrook. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and I come from a large family, a family of seven, and we were born literally up and down the East Coast. So I was born in North Carolina, but my family settled in the Portland area, actually Westbrook.
Well, fantastic. So talk a little bit about growing up in Maine and then your choice in terms of academics and going to University of Southern Maine, mm-hmm. and then how that kind of directed you into healthcare and nursing and, mm-hmm. and that part of your career, I guess.
Well, you know, I having said that, growing up in a large family of seven, my dad was in the Coast Guard. He'd be gone for 6 months at a time, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom raising us. And so we came from very limited means. And so I'm just going to lay that foundation because it's going to answer some questions later on about why I'm so invested in the community. But, you know, I did fairly well in school and wanted to be a nurse. And the reason I probably wanted to be a nurse is I had a younger sister who had a health issue. She had a seizure once when we were babysitting her. And some neighbors came to the house and quickly were able to manage the situation. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want to do. So I was one of the first people in my family to go on to school. And so I looked around at colleges, and UMaine was affordable. I wanted to get that college experience, wanted to go away, and got some scholarships and went to Orono. At the time, the nursing program, you couldn't finish all 4 years there. So I had to return the last 2 years to USM to do a lot of the clinical rotations and graduated from USM.
Okay, and then after graduating from USM, you decided to stay in Maine? So talk a little bit about how your first entry into the job market in terms of how that led you down the path that ultimately brought you to CEO of VNA Home Health Hospice.
Well, in nursing school, I really had a passion for home health. We did a community health rotation. And that's where, for me, it all came together, everything I was learning in school. I had to go into a home independently and make an assessment of someone's health and advise them and consult with physicians. And so I really wanted to do that. But I didn't feel quite prepared to do that level of independent practicing right out of school. So I went to work at Maine Medical Center and then got a lot of clinical experience there. And then, as often goes, met my husband, raised a family, and through the family raising, did a number of different jobs just to make ends meet and worked in a number of different hospitals in different settings. But home health was always my passion, so I did spend a lot of my career being a visiting nurse. And along the path was tapped, if you will, or recruited to try supervisory jobs. And so it goes, supervisor to branch manager to clinical director to CEO.
Well, you make it seem so easy, but I know there was a lot more work and a lot more accomplishment tied to that. Oh. By the way, we have Mayor Colleen Hilton. Mayor Hilton is mayor in Westbrook, and also that is not a full-time position, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but her full-time position is CEO of VNA Home Health and Hospice. So you made the CEO transition sound very smooth. So since 2002, you've been the CEO of VNA Home Health Hospice. Why don't we spend a minute talking a little bit about what VNA Home Health Hospice is organizationally? I've been doing research for this interview, and both in terms of the size and the scope and the number of folks you help, incredibly impressive. So talk a little bit about VNA, and then we'll talk a little bit about your role as CEO.
Sure. Well, VNA, you know, oftentimes I think with home health and hospice, unless it touches your life, you often don't know about it. In healthcare, we know about hospitals and clinics because we see them, we can touch them, feel them. But in home care, it's very different. So most of the people that we care for in the home are confined to the home, unable to get out to another setting. So recovering from an illness or actively dying. And VNA, we care for, in the course of a day, on average, in our home health program, over 550 people a day. And if you think about a hospital like Maine Medical Center, 600-bed-plus hospital, Mercy, 200-plus-bed hospital, home health, 550 people a day we're caring for. So if you think of that in terms of scope, in our hospice program, our average daily census is around 60. So on any given day, we're helping 60 families make that transition. And from a revenue standpoint, we do about 15 to 16 million a year in revenue. We employ over 240 people, various clinicians, and we also run some home-based clinic programs. We go into communities, into primarily senior housing settings, and do some outreach and health promotion, things like that. In the past year, we've added a new program, which is called Life Stages. And that is a non-medical, primarily companions and homemakers. We really want to help seniors age in place. If you think about the cost of health care, if you've ever had a loved one in a nursing home, it's, you know, roughly in Maine, $8,000 a month. Assisted living could be 3,000 to 5,000, but we can help people stay at home with a little bit of support for well under that. And so we've got a lot of innovative programs to really help people age in place in their homes.
So with the scope of the people you're working with, 500 or 600 people a day, if all of that was under one roof, it would almost be comparable in institutional size to Maine Med.
Well, for sure.
But you're doing it all across Maine, which adds the complexity of transportation and just distance and time and space.
Think about the weather, Steve.
I think about it today. We've got a hazy shade of winter going on here today, as we talked about.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the business structure as being part of Mercy Health System and how, what is the primary funding source in terms of any balance between private and public funding support for VNA Home Health Hospice?
Well, first on the funding source, I would say probably 80% of our clients are seniors, and so primarily it's Medicare. A very small percent is Medicaid or MaineCare in Maine, same thing, Medicaid. And then in our life stages, that program is probably 90% private pay. But the vast majority of our reimbursement comes from Medicare, although some people do pay us privately. As far as the affiliation with Mercy, that happened back in 1996. And so if you think back to various healthcare reforms, managed care models were the new buzz, and everyone's always trying to get a grip on how to control healthcare cost. And so managed care was, you know, the big buzz. Everyone thought we've got to have access to the full continuum, or we're not going to be able to contract.
Right.
So most hospitals at that time looked around and either purchased or partnered with another agency to provide the full continuum. So we had very similar missions and a good values fit with Mercy. So we came together with Mercy back in 96.
So are you integrated into the Mercy system, or is it more like you're aligned and VNA operates fairly independently?
No, we're very much aligned, and we work on clinical programs together. My role, I have a dual role, so I report as the CEO to a community-based board of directors, but I also report to Eileen Skinner, the president and CEO of Mercy, and I'm also serving as the vice president for home health and hospice at Mercy Health System of Maine.
We have Colleen Hilton here in the studio, CEO of VNA Home Health Hospice, also mayor of Westbrook. Talk a little bit about the makeup here in Maine. We have about 1.3 million people, and I think everyone's tired of the statistic that we're the oldest state in the country. But it is a reality. I reject most of the time how that's positioned, because there's nothing in Maine that's making people age artificially faster than anywhere else. I think in that case, we're losing 18 to 34-year-old, that demographic. And but the reality is we have many seniors here. So relative to VNA and home health hospice, talk a little bit about what's unique about Maine and how you're able to serve such a large population, not just in terms of the numbers, but in terms of the geography in Maine, because we have about 35,000 square miles, and that in itself has to be a huge challenge.
Yeah, our staff on any given year travel almost three-quarters of a million miles to deliver services in the home. And the thing I think about Mainers and aging Mainers is they're a feisty group. My parents are alive and well. My dad's 85. My mom's 83. They were at the Foxwood Casino yesterday. You know, they're still active and engaged and, you know, really doing well. So my view of aging is probably a little different than others, because we care for people well into their 90s. And in my role as the mayor, I got a call from a constituent to go see a lady in Westbrook who was going to be celebrating a birthday, and she was 103.
Wow.
She wasn't under care with anybody. She was at home supporting herself, living alone. She had a little bit of help from a friend for housekeeping. I went to visit her. She came to the door. She greeted me. We visited for an hour, had a great chat. And so people are doing some really good healthy aging in the state of Maine, and those that are having challenges reach out to companies like mine and others to really see what little support we can provide to really extend the time when people can stay in their own homes longer.
I think that's great. Let's talk, broaden the subject a little bit in terms of Affordable Care Act, which is timely and topical now. And then more specifically here in Maine and MaineCare, it's both a political debate, it's a financial debate, but I believe on its core level, it's also an important human debate having to do with our humanities and how we how we treat healthcare. Is it a service? Is it a support service? Or is it a right that every American, every Mainer, I believe we do. I think there's certain rights that we have, and I think healthcare is something common to all of us, from prenatal care to hospice care. But talk a little bit on the policy issue of Affordable Care Act and MaineCare, how that has impacted you and your role as CEO of VNA, and any thoughts you have on the current policy discussion.
Sure. I have all kinds of thoughts on that policy discussion. Being in a system like Mercy and VNA, we're very mission-driven. In our mission statement alone, it's with special concern for the poor and disadvantaged. And that doesn't mean a handout. I worry a lot about the rhetoric that I hear around this issue, because so many of the people that we see are not looking for a handout. They're looking for some help. They're looking for a bridge. They don't have access to health care. They don't have access to insurance, affordable insurance. Sort of back to one of your earlier points, if we could put more focus on economic development and bringing jobs to Maine, we maybe could retain some of that age cohort you mentioned that is exiting. And very near and dear to my heart, I have a 26-year-old. So, you know, once kids turn 26, they can no longer be on their parents' insurance.
I have a 23-year-old who's on my insurance, so it touches me both as a family and with many of my employees.
Right. So as a young man, I have three children, but he's 26. He has two jobs. He works more than 40 hours a week, actually has a third job. But he doesn't have access to health insurance because he's cobbled together part-time jobs. So he is someone who now, with Affordable Care Act, can go on the website, which I've shown him how to do, and very easy to go in and pull up some plans, and he can get a subsidy. He's eligible for a subsidy. He would still have to pay, probably based on the plan we selected, which was a really good plan. He could do it much cheaper if he decides to. He has to make a decision. For around $200 a month. And that's affordable for him. But for him, with what he brings home for a wage, trying to pay for an apartment, pay for a car, pay for, you know,
day-to-day
car
living,
insurance,
sure,
and everything else, that's tough. Another friend of his who works doing a lot of daycare is getting some health insurance for $25 a month. So I think it's unfair. What I'm hearing in the public discussion is to characterize everybody as just living off the system. These are people that are working hard, that are trying to make ends meet, but health insurance, let's face it, is just highly, highly unaffordable for the average Mainer.
For the average American. And I look at it as, in you're a provider of services for people, mostly in terms of home health, and you do some business stuff, but I don't know how we get to this place in 2014. When you look back in the history of healthcare, at one point in the middle or in the latter stages of the Industrial Revolution in America, somehow we connected healthcare with jobs and companies. And you look at other countries and you look at other developed countries, and they didn't have that linkage. Mm-hmm. And so part of the struggle with Affordable Care Act is changing the paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and whether you work for a big company or a little company, or you have three part-time jobs or four, we all need health care. Mm-hmm. We all get sick. We all need medicine at some point. We all need medical services. So I think the quicker we can de-link this critical human need, economic need, this impact element of health care, from the idea of the employer pays this, you pay this, I think we're better off as a society.
Are you making a plug for universal health care?
I'm making a plug for smart health care.
I'd be right there with you.
And the plug is, you know, whenever people say universal health care, people talk about socialism or something else, to me it's not a political posturing. It is something that is practical. It's something that if you look at other countries, something that works to varying degrees. Yep. And anyone can make an argument that in one place or another there's flaws in the system. Mm-hmm. But every single American at some point in their life, from prenatal to final care, hospice care, needs and deserves respectful health care in the continuum of life. And to link it in such a way that employment becomes such a driving criteria in terms of the cost, the fees, the burdens, mm-hmm. just doesn't make sense. And I'm an employer, and I offer health care to all my full-time employees, mm-hmm. and we have a great program. But it just doesn't make sense. It just, mm-hmm. you know, and so when people say, oh, let's, you know, and my personal view on the Affordable Care Act is it's not perfect, but for decades, mm-hmm. every administration, every session of Congress knew that things were going out of control, knew that costs were skyrocketing. And to me, it's life or death. Mm-hmm. So it's not policy, and it's not, you know, should we build another ship, should we not, or should... It is the decisions being made over the last couple of years and currently going on in Washington and here in Maine. Those decisions have a direct and indirect effect on people's lives, mm-hmm. living and dying. And mm-hmm. so I just want to see the conversation right. get closer mm-hmm. to it's life and death. So not, mm-hmm. let's not look at it mm-hmm. as, well, it's going to be an extra 200,000. People are living and dying based on policies around healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, a lot of the Affordable Care Act is not so much health reform, it's payment reform.
Right.
And I think what you're seeing, we're seeing right now, I'm living in extraordinary changes that are happening in the industry. And much like you saw Mercy Health System recently need to merge with a larger health system, the payment for health services is flawed. And hospitals are required, physicians are required to care for people whether they have insurance or not.
Right.
So we've really got to step back and really tackle that issue. And I think that's what Affordable Care Act is trying to do. You have provisions in the Affordable Care Act that don't allow you to be denied insurance because of your health status. I recently had a good friend who died of leukemia. I honestly worried before the Affordable Care Act was fully implemented, would he reach that threshold where he'd be shut off from his insurance? And that can't happen anymore. I have a niece who has a cardiac anomalies, and I've worried, she's 26, how is she ever going to get health insurance? Once people discover, you know, the extent of her potential cost, will she not be afforded a job? So we really have some really admirable things that have been realized during the Affordable Care Act. But I think we still have a long way to go with payment reform. And what we're seeing is moving away from fee-for-service, which was, I'll just keep seeing you and I'll just keep getting insurance money for you and, you know, more and more and more, to let's pay health systems to care for populations.
Right.
And let's do that in the most affordable way. Let's do that in the least restrictive setting.
And smart, whether it's preventative right. care versus treatment right. care. I look at it the same way. And we could talk about the broad scope in America, but to focus on Maine, if we have 1.3 million people mm-hmm. and everyone at some point needs some health care services or treatment or – and – so you have the 1.3 million people on one side of this imaginary scale that I'm drawing here on mm-hmm. the table. And then on the other side, you have doctors and physicians and medical staff. You have institutional support like hospitals and technology and MRIs. And then you have important drugs and pharmacy mm-hmm. services. Those things are fairly static. The 1.3 million people on one side, the services on the other. It's the transaction in the middle that I think that we can really work on making more efficient. And because in the transaction, and everyone beats up on the insurance companies, but they have some nice buildings, you know. And the idea of some insurance person in a cubicle talking to somebody on the phone saying, I'm sorry, Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith, mm-hmm. We've looked at your chart, and because of this pre-existing thing or because you're out of scope of this, we're no longer going to be able to pay mm-hmm. for this treatment. That life or death decision, I don't believe, should be made in a cubicle of an insurance company.
No, it shouldn't. But the other thing we need to spend more time on is preventing disease.
Right.
And we've done, I mean, look at phys ed in school. They pretty much abandoned all of the healthy, you know, health education, physical activity, phys ed. There's so much we could do to prevent disease to begin with from a health system that we don't put enough focus on public health. There's lots of screenings that we could do. There's lots of education that we could do. So I think we need to really put more emphasis there. The other sort of statistic that gets overlooked often and often will sort of generate some heated debate is around end-of-life care. We have 80% of the spend happening in the last 10 days of life. Why do we do that? Because we don't want to talk about that.
Well, let's talk about it. Here on Tide Swear Talk with Steve-O, I have Colleen Hilton. Colleen is the CEO of V&A Home Health Hospice. She is also the mayor of Westbrook. That analysis, that review, that discussion is an intersection of our humanities, our intersection of how we value life and try to measure it. And there's also some very real financial economic consequence to our policies one way or the other. And that was the first, I think, for the Republican Party when they were trying to stop Affordable Care Act at the very start. Mm-hmm. The bumper sticker had to do with death squads,
right,
or Obama's going to decide who lives and dies. But it really is an important discussion for you to point out that stat, that so much of the health care expense currently goes to a relatively short period of time. But how should we look at it? In given your work in home health and hospice, I can't think of anyone in Maine, and as an RN yourself, that is in a position to have a thought on that. So what do you think is the correct way for us to approach it, both from a policy standpoint and as a healthcare provider?
Well, I think things are changing. We're starting to see articles in mainstream media, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Portland Press. You're starting to see articles that are addressing the complexity of end of life. Before, we didn't talk about it, quite frankly. And I have this conversation often with people that, when we're going to have a baby, people take classes, they go out and get books, they ask you what's a good book, who's a good doctor, what's a good birthing experience? What hospital should I go to?
I had my kids. I went to babycenter.com. You register.
Yes,
you use
yes,
technology. You
right,
get information.
Right. But on the other end of life, we sort of go into shutdown. We stop talking about it. So we need to talk about it. And I actually got a call this week from a lovely couple in Connecticut. And they run a program in their retirement community. I think it was called Care and Compassion. And they're trying to force the Connecticut legislation to really look at those issues of end of life and to encourage docs. And not all doctors in their training are really comfortable with talking about end of life. They were trained to heal and to cure. And so there's a real specialty. And so in the Affordable Care Act, there was the caveat to encourage discussions with patients about palliative care and end-of-life care. And then you saw what happened. Everyone said death squads, we're going to ration health care, we're going to let people die if they're disabled. That's just not the case. So I think organizations like mine and many others across the state are really trying to open up the dialogue about end-of-life care. Have your choices made well in advance. What do you want done when you get to that point? It's okay to talk about it. We've got to get more comfortable talking about it.
I think in general, death is such an uncomfortable conversation for most of us to have. And the irony is it's one of the most major elements that's common to all of us, right?
Right.
So here in Maine, are there policy issues on either the state level or are there healthcare issues with MaineCare that you think should reflect that point of view that we should talk about it, but should we also do something relative to policy, relative to funding, or is that something that is too personal for government to inject itself in?
I think there are times when it's appropriate. There's a movement called Pulsed. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. And so that's encouraging doctors and patients to have that dialogue about what if, and what if, and what would you like done. And there are times when I think there could be some encouragement to look at tort reform, and so that physicians are not afraid of being sued if they don't do everything extraordinary. And there often are very emotional times when a crisis occurs, the unexpected, a horrible stroke or something just that you could not predict. And, you know, people rush in and they don't really know what to do in those times. So, again, I think it all comes back to having the dialogue with your physician well in advance, speaking with your attorneys are getting online advance directives that say what you want done.
I think that's good advice for anyone listening, anyone at home. Really, it's a discussion, and it's thinking about it thoughtfully and at the same time being respectful of life, but at least having the discussion to try to get some information, some understanding before people. Because when you're in that urgent moment where mm-hmm. somebody is unconscious, somebody's in a coma, somebody is, mm-hmm. that is probably the most difficult time to try to apply mm-hmm. critical thinking. What would mom want? What would right. dad want? What's in the will? Is mm-hmm. there a directive? That mm-hmm. type of thing. So I think that's great advice. If you wouldn't mind, I'd love to shift a little bit. I could talk about this sure. all day, and I'd love yeah. to have you come back. We have Colleen Hilton. Colleen is the CEO of ENA Health, Home Health and Hospice. She is also in her third term as mayor of Westbrook. So I'd like to shift a little bit to your role in Westbrook and how you first got involved in politics, in government, and then talk a little bit about your role as mayor in Westbrook.
Sure. You know, I still don't think I'm in politics.
I say the same thing.
I don't.
I don't even like it. I'm the chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council, so when somebody says, well, you politicians are all...
Don't you react to that?
I'm here at 6 in the morning working with people, doing things, and maybe it's just the time we're in, but saying somebody's a politician, there's a connotation to mm-hmm. it where I prefer public service. I prefer government service. Right. I'm trying to help out in the community.
Right.
I'm not trying to make politics my career.
Neither.
Thank you for correcting me, because I feel the same
way. I do. I feel like I'm a servant leader.
Right.
I believe that. And so, you know, if I hearken back to my family, we got a lot of help from our community when we were growing up. My family did. And then my dad, when he retired from the Coast Guard, served as was called an alderman back there, but city councilor. And, you know, a lot of my family members have served on local planning board. And my parents raised us to with the value that if you live in this community, you give back to the community, you participate in the community. So to me, it's just second nature. And when I moved back to Westbrook, the mayor at the time, Don Estes, approached me at a football game and said, you know, we have an opening on the school board. And I just moved back to Westbrook. And I said, oh, what does that entail? And they said, oh, it's a couple meetings a month. I said, well, I could handle that. So there began my journey into, if you will, politics. But I don't view it as politics. I view it as service to the school community. So I served on the Westbrook School Committee for 10 years, and many of those years as the chair. And I think we accomplished some really good things. And again, it's just that notion of giving back to your community and doing what you can to improve the situation.
And then, you know, how did that transition? And by the way, my notes here says that you're the first female mayor in Westbrook history.
Yes.
And I had to go online. So I'm obviously familiar with a little bit how local government and municipal government works. So you work in conjunction with the city council in Westbrook. And looking at the city council lineup,
it's very male dominated.
There's Brendan, there's Michael, there's John, there's Paul, there's Victor, there's another Michael, and then there's Morgan. So you have these seven gentlemen, which I think is great, and I'm sure they are all committed to their service. But you're the first female. So tell me a little bit about what the transition from school board to being Westbrook's first female mayor.
Well, at the after being on the school board for 10 years, I thought it was a good time to, you know, do something different. And I felt that things were in good shape. So I was kind of looking around for, you know, what will I do next? Where will I put my excess energy to good use? And I was approached by a number of people to consider running for mayor, which really made me laugh because I'd never served on the council. And my response was, well, I don't know anything about sewers.
That's funny.
I don't really know much about roads and potholes other than when I hit them. So you don't want me to run for mayor. And so I think the very involved in the Democratic Party and their thinking was that I could unseat an incumbent who had been in the role for a period of time, and a couple of good challengers had gone up against him and hadn't won. So the thinking was I had some respect and some credibility, and I might be able to pull off the victory. So I took one for the team, said I would do it, and surprisingly got elected.
So since November 2009, and talk a little bit in the city form of government, the role of mayor versus of the city council in Westbrook, and where your authority is delineated from the council and where you work together and collaborate.
Well, it's funny, as soon as I was elected, and again, I was the first female, and I did not know that when I was running. I couldn't even imagine that that could possibly be true, but that was true. And when I was elected, I was called by a lot of reporters that wanted to run a story because they were letting me know that the form of mayor government in Westbrook is some of the strongest forms of mayor government in the state of Maine, to which I really wasn't familiar. I knew I had read the charter and I knew what I would be doing, but I had no idea the scope of the responsibility compared to other communities. So the form in Westbrook, they're different from every community. Some mayors are ceremonial, some like Mayor Brennan in Portland, and I'm sure you followed all of that, was elected, but he doesn't have the same authority that I do in Westbrook. So I function very much like a CEO in Westbrook, hiring and firing all of the department heads rest with me. And so we work together with the council, seven-member council. It's a very collaborative relationship, and we do have the majority are Democrats, but honestly, I don't think in terms of party. We have one sole Republican, and we have an independent now that was recently elected. But I don't – everybody's unique, in my opinion.
And there's also a city administrator, right, that there's handles the day-to-day
City administrator, Jerry Bryant, and he is the – you know, really the operations running the business of the city every day.
Yeah, that was something that came up 4 years ago when our current governor, LePage, was campaigning. And up in Waterville, he was campaigning, and he continues to campaign for re-election as former mayor of Waterville.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years before he was elected, Waterville went to a weak mayor system. And not to diminish his role on the council in Waterville, which I have respect for anyone who runs for office and serves, but it just wasn't factual to say he was responsible as this leadership entity as mayor, because in the Waterville council, it is a different, completely different form of government where it is more ceremonial, and each member of the council has an equal vote and an equal fiduciary constitutional role. But in Westbrook, it's different. In Portland, it's different. And in your case, there's more authority into the role of mayor, right?
Right. And it functions much like the state government, that the mayor's making recommendations, and it's the council that essentially has to pass. You know, they're the voting body. So in our city, it works well, I think. There's good healthy debate often, and there's good balance of opinions, and I think we're doing some really good work in Westbrook.
Talk a little bit about local government and specifically your experience in Westbrook and both the school committee for 10 years and now since 2009 being mayor. I've noticed something prior to being chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council. I was chair of the planning board. And so for 6 or 7 years, I've been involved with local government, and I share your view that it is I look at it as servant government. I don't accept a fee for being on the council. I donate it to the local energy group. I'm running for state senate now. If I'm successful in that campaign, I wouldn't accept compensation. My plan is to ask the state to allocate that to educational funds in all the municipalities I'd represent. I really do believe that when our democracy was set up 238 years ago or something like that, it was designed for people to participate. And somehow we've lost that, in my opinion, over the last 50 years. And you see it on the federal level. You see it now more so up in Augusta, where things are very contentious. In the last 5 years, it feels like the economic pressure has trickled down. And now in local town and city government, things are getting and sometimes more contentious. There have been, you know, down in Old Orchard Beach, I think there were some counselors. There was a recall in Freeport. There was a town manager who was dismissed early. There's meetings and lawsuits and freedom of information requests. Things have gotten much more testy and much more contentious. From all of your experience in the last 15 years in government, do you see, you feel the same thing in Westbrook and some ideas that you may have for how how do we change that?
God, that is, I'm so, really, you hit the nail right on the head. It is a problem. And I think it's not unique to just local government, civil discourse. It's really getting ugly. And I spent a lot of my time reminding people that I'm representing 17,000 plus people in the city of Westbrook. Right. And we cannot govern to the 10 loudest voices in the city. And I think you see that from community to community, that there are a select few that choose to get involved, and their way of getting involved is just to be either a contrarian or suspicious of everything that government's trying to do. And so it's, in my opinion, I spent a lot of time talking to the community about you need to put yourself out there. You see the school board races lately, they're primarily uncontested. It's almost like no one's willing to either put themselves out there.
Right.
But you put yourself out there, and like I did as the mayor and made some, which I thought were appropriate and normal changes when I first entered the office.
The six people you let go?
Oh, no.
I know. I think it was three.
Steve,
it was three. But, yeah. The media. But the
media went crazy on it.
As if you were doing something draconian.
The charter said my responsibility was to appoint the department heads. And once I was elected in November to the inaugural, which at the time was the first Monday in January, I needed to make some important decisions. So I began a process of evaluating performance and evaluating the organization, if you will, from November to January. But the charter required me to make those appointments on my inaugural address. And so that's what I did. But the people that I didn't choose to keep in the current roles were informed in advance of that.
Right.
But the press spun that the way the press spins things. But I think once you do something like that, I mean, I had family members attacked and verbally attacked in grocery stores. I had people showing up at my house.
I had somebody show up here two nights ago, you know, a resident of Yarmouth, and she was livid. And the challenge in Westbrook has its own set of challenges, and we have in Yarmouth. In this economy, there are many people hurting. I empathize with that, and I try to do everything I can do to help and assist. But I think people are also looking to blame somebody because in some ways, I don't know if it offers comfort, but it offers some sort of sense of direction for the anger or the rage. But elected officials, and as you know, in Westbrook and Falmouth and Yarmouth, people serve, and for the most part, it's a volunteer thing. I was meeting last night till almost 11 o'clock on a council meeting talking about sewer fees.
Yeah.
Not because I really
love talking about sewer fees, right.
But we've lost $250 million in revenue basis in Yarmouth with a power plant, the Wyman Station, that's gone from $300 million in property value down to 50. And over the last 10 years, it's shifted to the taxpayers. And so trying to explain that and inform the electorate and say, hey, we all have a challenge here. But I get it. But it doesn't make the job any easier. And that effect stops more people from getting involved in the process because they see this and they go, well, I don't want to run and be part of that.
But even beyond that, what I worry about is it keeps really talented municipal employees from wanting to. I worry about retaining really talented individuals because they are under the gun 24/7. And
we've all lost people. And I don't know the specific budget parameters in Westbrook, but if Westbrook's anything like any other municipality, over the last 5 years, jobs have been consolidated. Departments have shared resources. You've extended pavement programs. You've cut down on vehicle replacement. So across the board, everyone has made sacrifices. And I agree. And for the people out there, just public works with the weather we've had this winter. But we've lost some of the capacity to be able to say, you know what, government's not bad. There are times when I feel good about my municipal government, my state government, my federal government. But it feels like it's harder and harder for people to see.
Yeah, I call it magical thinking. I read some article once where people want you to cut, don't raise my taxes, but keep the service levels the same.
Right.
We've been very creative in Westbrook, and we've done a lot of regional efforts, and we're going to continue to do more and more regional efforts to try to keep keep things affordable and to keep the tax rates down. But it's becoming more and more challenging to do that. We've outsourced lawn mowing. You know, we've really skinnied down public works to the bare essential. I can tell you right now I need more police officers. And I'm not sure if I can afford more right now, but I need more. We need to make important investments, and we're doing that. But it's a balance. And what's really sort of back to your earlier point, what's really tough is to be hammered. And some of us can take that hammering, I think, better than others. And maybe in my experience as an administrator, I'm used to making decisions and moving forward and keeping my eye on the vision and not on the here and now. But I worry sometimes, especially with new school committee members, new city councilors, it is tough to go out publicly and put yourself out there and just to be pummeled and hammered and criticized. And sometimes electronic communication is a beautiful thing because now people can reach out electronically to their elected officials. But it would be really nice if people, and I do reply to every email I get, if people would start an email with, could you tell me about or what about versus what were you thinking? How stupid are you? That's the kind of dialogue that's
You've been
there.
Reading my email, haven't you? You have been hacking into my email, Colin.
So people just need to get back to that place of respect. And it's just basic. Ask a question. I'll answer anything, really. I'm very transparent. But assumptions are made and then rumors flow and I was asked a question during this recent run for mayor, ran against two other individuals. We were having a debate, and there's a park in downtown Westbrook called Sac Rapid Park. And the question was, would you consider developing Sac Rapid Park? One of the Republican candidates said, no, I wouldn't. Well, he owns a building right next to it also. That's where his tenants hang out. The other individual said, no, absolutely not. And I said, well, for the right project, I would consider it. And that has blossomed to, a citizen referendum to try to save the park. And I don't even have anything on the agenda for the park. It was just an answer to a question.
It became a catalyst for somebody to kind of focus their dissatisfaction. In the remaining couple of minutes, in addition, we've covered healthcare a little bit. We've covered government. I wanted to ambush you with an educational initiative because you were on the school committee for 10 years. And it kind of ties into what we're talking about. My hypothesis is that many of the problems we're facing now are not indigenous to different people serving, that it's our fault. It is every single person in Maine. It's every single person in the country. We own our democracy. Across Maine, we graduate about 10 to 12,000 seniors every year. Many of them are either 18 or about to be 18 by the time their graduating June comes around, which for most communities, they have municipal elections. 98% of seniors don't know the difference between a referendum and a refrigerator, because in many school districts, government and civics is taught in fifth and seventh grade as part. Mm-hmm. I would like, in the final week of every senior mm-hmm. year, for school districts to commit 6 hours, because most of the time may be wasted anyhow. Mm-hmm. And in hour one, just show the kids something about local governments. So in a nonpartisan way, for 1 hour, here's how Westbrook government works. Here's mm-hmm. how the council works. Here's how the mayor works. The second hour, here's how county government works. Mm-hmm. Here's how third hour, here's how state legislature, here's how. And for 6 hours, because to graduate 12,000 Mainers every year and continue this pattern of non-political engagement, it becomes multi-generational. Mm-hmm. If we don't tell these kids that democracy is important, the process becomes intimidating and we don't break the cycle. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm trying to say?
Well, I'm not so sure that they're not doing civics in high school. I think they do have part of that built into the curriculum. I think it's a great idea. If you could carve that out, more power to you. I would be supportive of that. I frequently go to the primary grades and do a little civics lessons with some of the counselors, and we have some really good results from that. But in Westbrook, we're one of the first communities to bring onto the school committee. We brought on students, and Mike Foley, who's a phenomenal young man who's still serving as a counselor at the age of 26 or 7, came on when he was 16.
Wow.
And we also added in Westbrook two students. Morgan Riley is one. Mm-hmm. And
Trina Sayad.
Trina Sayad is the other. And every year that changes. A senior graduates, we bring another one on. So what we're trying to do is engage those students to go back to schools and talk about how things work. And then collectively, I think as parents of kids, my kids can be very opinionated. I've got a 29-year-old, and I've been saying to him, you can do something about that.
Right.
You know, when you're getting all worked up, you can do something about that.
Every public meeting has a public comment period. You can volunteer.
Something about that.
You can join something.
And he's doing that. So he's getting engaged in the community. But I think we all have a responsibility to continue to encourage our youth to be involved and to let them know they can make a difference.
We only have time for one final question. I have Colleen Hilton here in the studio. Colleen is the mayor of Westbrook and also the CEO of ENA Home Health Hospice. Recently came out in the news yesterday in the paper that Westbrook is looking at a possible concert venue. Is there any update, and how did that come about that Westbrook may want to get into the public music or public concert venue business?
We brought Bill Baker on, who's just phenomenal, just really doing an incredible job to push some economic development in the city of Westbrook. And we've opened up the river access. We've put some docks into the river to let people know you can actually use the Penobscot River and you can kayak on it. And we're going to give you some easy access to rent some boats to get on the river.
Right.
But I think a lot of those efforts have brought attention to our riverfront, which is what we're trying to do. And we were approached by a very notable concert promoter, and they're very interested in our location. And then meanwhile, the South Portland.
Right. So it's still very preliminary, but again, it could be something that happens either this year or in the future. And,
mm-hmm.
But it's about economic development and really using the resources in the city to help business and provide entertainment and services mm-hmm. for the residents.
Yeah, think about the Bangor waterfront
right.
venue. Very similar.
We've run out of time, but I hope you'll come back sometime. This has
sure.
been a real treat
yeah.
having you.
Oh, you're kind.
And we've only covered 3 out of the 19 categories. But thank you so much for
sure.
being with
Thanks
us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We've had Colleen Hilton, mayor of Westbrook, CEO of ENA Home Health. You're listening to News Talk, WLOB, 1310 a.m. Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. We'll be back.